I've walked way past midnight. I've driven for days. I've tried to forget in so many ways. I've held other arms, but they don't feel the same. And I've only myself to blame.
Hello and welcome to another Odd Job pod as we continue going deep into the world of villainry. In fact, we've gone so deep, we've come out the other side, much like James Bond from a North Korean prison at the start of Die Another Day. This is the last set of Bond villains that we're discussing in depth before we go full World Cup on you all. This is very much deciding who will be the France or Germany of Bond villains, or topping a group at any rate, and who will be the poor San Marino or Andorra. Probably not Luxembourg because they are improving slightly. This is the last set of Bond villains, and as ever, I will be joined by Terry DeFellin and Graham Sibley. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. The Bond villains that we've got on this are a much more modern era, I think it's fair to say. And ones that certainly some Bond aficionados may even have a slight look down their nose at, potentially. Are they worthy of such a glance? Are they worthy of the disdain that Bond would give to anybody who drinks red wine with fish? We shall find out. The villains that we will be discussing are Alec Trevelyan, Elektra King, Gustav Graves, and Dominic Green, which would make quite a Question Time panel, I think.
Bloody hell, Dominic Green again.
We're always getting that guy there. Classic BBC bias.
What are they doing on there?
God, him and his environmental agenda again.
Jabbering on again. I wish someone would just dump him in the middle of a desert.
Should we start with Dominic Green then?
Why not? Yes, let's start at the end, shall we? Yeah.
Why not? We have a question here from Terry from Whiteleaf in Croydon. Terry, I believe that you wish to ask Dominic Green about what would happen in the event of a no deal and looking for get ferry terminals involved. So Dominic Green, this actually feels a very appropriate intro, not that it was entirely planned that way, but because Dominic Green is a villain who is I personally actually quite like his character, but really, Graham, let's face it, he's just a middle manager, isn't he? He's somebody who's been promoted above his station and was always destined to fail.
Yeah, he's a modern-day Kronstein, isn't he? He's just someone who is facilitating for someone else. Where we see... we had Le Chiffre in the last film, who we've mentioned already in previous podcasts about how this is a guy who was a supervillain in the making. Although he is a middle manager, he is someone who's moving out. He is actually branching out on his own, and that's why he gets in so much trouble, because Spectre doesn't like that, or Quantum doesn't like that, as it was. And obviously, the film franchise has to go through some loops to try and rejig that back into Spectre and everything else for the later films. But yeah. Obviously, Quantum of Solace has a lot of problems with it. It's one of those films that has gone through... happened a lot throughout the franchise when you have one really big film and then they think, great, we've got to get another one out as quickly as possible, and they do, and it's it is, for want of a better word, a turkey.
It is, yes. I mean, it suffers twice because, one, it's rushed because, obviously, it's like, well, we need to do another one. And also, it happens in the middle of a writer's strike. And it shows. And it's missing that polish to the script. And I'm sure that's one of the problems with it, which is why I think you can't aim any blame at all at the actors in this situation, because I mean it's just they're having to work with what they've got. I mean I can see why they've gone for someone like Green. He's kind of, you know, in some respects he's a bit like Le Chiffre in that he's a European, you know, yeah. And he's with a kind of fairly cool and, you know, fairly sort of like disarming exterior, but you know, but what he's missing, of course, is that hard edge to him. You're never convinced that this guy is for real in terms of villainry. You don't think he can necessarily see it through. He's clearly a callous man, but you never really quite get the sense that he is truly murderous, you know, or capable of seeing through, you know, the batty plans of his fellow board members. I think Mr. White is a more convincing villain in many ways than Dominic Green.
Yeah.
Mm, I mean, Graham, I think that's kind of almost worth saying, because when you look at Quantum or Spectre, as it becomes, once you get towards into the last Bond film, there is, because again, it almost touches on what we talked on the last podcast with From Russia With Love, this is kind of the Craig era from Russia With Love, albeit nowhere near as good, although I have a bit of a soft spot for Quantum of Solace. It's a, you know, it's not an unwatchable film, and it's one that has its moments, albeit not as good as many of the other, but it's nowhere near as good as the other films in the Craig era. But this is very similar insofar as it starts becoming, you know, the master plan is very much something that actually is a bit more spy to disrupt into there. It's not the most pleasant thing, but it doesn't feel like there's huge amounts of kind of peril put on anybody in there. It's just a few unpleasant people getting together. But yeah, to Terry's point, that you've got Mr. White in there as well. You've got a lot of other kind of very minorish kind of villains around there. You've got General Modano as well, who you know is equally an incredibly nasty piece of work and meets a demise in that regard. Graham, would you feel this is kind of, you know, this is almost a Craig. And Green is to Craig maybe what Cronstein was to the Connery era.
Yeah, he was. I think you're right. Quantum of Solace is a watchable film, and one of the reasons why it's watchable is that it's over and done with in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So you can fit it in half an hour quicker than you can with most other films. But because it's missing that half an hour, and because of, as Terry explained with the writer's strike, the nuance is gone from this film. So it does sort of strike you as a bunch of stuff that happens.
Yeah, I mean some really good chases, some good set pieces,
some
cracking locations, as well. I mean, particularly in Bolivia, some wonderful location, great. Stunning photography. I mean, the build quality of these of those Daniel Craig movies is second to none. I'm afraid I don't recall who the director of photography is. I probably ought to, but I mean, all of these movies are just so lavish now. The good thing about Quantum is that it doesn't overstay its welcome. Unlike Spectre, I'm bound to say, which does perhaps go on a little bit longer than it could do, could have tightened up. So, but yeah, there wasn't that much fat to cut off of that movie, because there's not much of a movie. It's not a great movie of substance, and that's obviously reflected in its main principal villain. But I am sure Matteo Almeric would have done. A much, much better job if he'd had a better character to work with. I'm certain of that. But at the same time, perhaps he just didn't occupy that same screen presence as that we're used to with so many. I mean, in our last podcast, we talked about Gert Frober as Goldfinger. Mm. I mean, you compare those two actors, they are playing the same kind of role. But obviously, you know, these two different actors are just not attuned to that. You don't expect, you know, that from Green. He just doesn't have that presence.
It's very difficult because he is following straight after Mads Mikkelsen.
Mm. Unhelpful.
Very unhelpful, because, I mean, although he's an accomplished actor in himself, you've got to think, I can't just come on and do what Mads Mikkelsen just did. So I've got to try and come up with something different.
And he was kind of being asked to do precisely that as well, which I thought is
unreasonable. He got a bit of a hospital pass there, didn't he, really?
He certainly did, yeah.
And then when you look at the other villains of the Craig era as well, you've got Javier Bardem, you've got Christoph Waltz. Basically, you've got a very heavyweight selection of actors, people who can are more than happy to sit there and, you know, chew as much scenery as they want, that they can go toe-to-toe in acting stakes with Daniel Craig, who's obviously no slouch himself in there. And you have, you know, you do feel, as you say, you do feel a bit sorry in this case. So almost in a way, Graham, if you kind of remove Green from the Craig era, does he hold up? Is he, you know, if you look at him across the whole pantheon of Bond villains, if you look at him throughout, you know, Brosnan and Moore and Connery, is he perhaps a little bit maligned? Is he just because the fact that the film's a little bit rushed and perhaps the script could have been a little bit better, and the fact that he suffers simply because of the other villains that have been present in his James Bond's access era?
Well, I think he certainly sits in the same sort of batch as people like Drax. That if he was around then, he would have been thought, okay, well, this guy's a bit villainous, but he just doesn't seem that menacing. For me, anyway.
Yeah, I can see him sitting okay opposite Tim Dalton, a Tim Dalton movie.
Yeah.
I can see that. I can see him sort of like settling in that kind of those sort of like late 80s kind of Dalton. If Dalton had done a third movie and, you know, they'd have gone for a character like Dominic Green, that might have worked.
It might have done,
because
of
the narrative, the tone of those Dalton movies.
The lower key nature.
Yeah, they were more low key.
Yeah, especially after, say after Walken in View to Kill.
Yes.
You know, where he really says, right, okay, well, if you bring a name in, they can go full on panto.
Mm.
Really,
yes.
with their flamboyance and just expression, and that's what you see in the later Craig films as well.
Yes,
you, really?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I mean, I think that he's just out of step, I think, with the era. I think that in a different era, he might have been have found a home, but I think that even that's being kind.
Well, but one thing I think we do have to say, Terry, is that he probably meets one of the most unpleasant ends of any Bond villain, and we don't get to see him.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really cold thing to do, isn't it? To, you know, I mean, because he's also given motor oil, isn't it?
Yeah.
As an alternative to dying of starvation.
Yeah.
I mean, he meets the end of a villain that's there are other villains who meet far better ends, I think. When I mean better, I think less painful and less horrific ends.
Mm.
Far more villainous James Bond villains. And I even that seems a little bit out of step. It's difficult. Am I almost feeling sorry for Dominic Green, the character, for the end that he meets? That seems incredibly brutal. I mean, just to remind listeners, he's abandoned in a Bolivian desert. He's given a can of motor oil and says, your choice is basically starve to death in the middle of this desert, you know, or end yourself, you know, by committing suicide by swallowing motor oil, which is just, you know, I mean, goodness. I mean, it's incredibly brutal, and I would suggest perhaps a bit out of step as well. I think that better writers would have thought that doesn't seem to be a very James Bond way of doing away with things. I mean, they want to be eaten by sharks, or they want to be, you know, you're dropped from a great height, perhaps. You know, I mean, this seems really cold. This is almost This is almost lowering Bond to the level of the villain. I mean, it's a villainous way to do away with somebody.
Yeah, this is. Well, I don't know. Is this as bad as like just dropping someone halfway into a shark tank so they got enough to have their legs bitten off?
Yeah, I mean, it is, really. Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly cold. And we know that there's an aspect of the Fleming Bond and of James Bond which can be cold and can be ruthless. I mean, he is capable of committing murder and capable of committing cold-blooded murder. But, I mean, like, this is sadistic.
Yeah.
And again, this is all things that are not inconsistent with James Bond's character, and any defenders of Quantum of Solace are quite right to point this out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not in step with the movie. The movie doesn't. There's not enough going on there. I know he does some unspeakable things, and I guess the murder of Fields is something that we should just think back on.
Yeah.
As something that he orchestrated, and these are reasons for him meeting a brutal end. But really, I don't know whether or not we've seen Bond really do away with a character in such a way that is that sadistic. Mm. I mean, it would have been probably the professional thing to do, would have just simply to have been picked up a gun and shot him, just executed him, if that was what it was going to be. But to give him this kind of ending...
Well, also as well, is that he's making the same mistake as everyone makes with him. Is turning his back on the villain.
And assuming everything goes to plan. Yeah, but unfortunately, or fortunately, the character isn't strong enough to possibly make a return. I don't think we'll ever see Dominic Green come back. No.
Yeah.
No.
Mm. Well, I mean, if we talk about death by falling from a great height, that seems like a nice segue into Alec Trevelyan, who was the... I think there's always something when you have a new Bond in and they have to establish it with a strong villain. And I found Alec Trevelyan, I've always found him a really fascinating character. Obviously, GoldenEye, he's the first of the Brosnan villains, and GoldenEye is still a great film, very, very watchable, very enjoyable. And you've got a really fascinating villain in there, insofar as, you know, somebody who knows Bond well, and... just the way that he goes about it is fascinating. Graham, your thoughts on Alec Trevelyan as played by Sean Bean?
Well, I really like this film, and I really like Trevelyan as a villain, because as a turncoat, as someone who as a traitor, probably not from his point of view, but. From our point of view, he is a traitor. And of course, the opening scene with when he is another 00 agent working with Bond, and which is something we don't normally see. It actually really opens it out a bit more. Bond working as part of a team rather than not leading someone else through a mission. And the way that Trevelyan has a character that builds up throughout there, although he's shown as being weaker than Bond in his moral fibre and the way he acts, and in the end he ends up losing to Bond.
Mm.
But as well, we've got this whole thing again with what we had were with From Russia with Love. We've got a team effort here, haven't we? Because there are lots of villains in this film. Obviously, Trevelyan is the leader, or he's the main driving force behind them. But it's the henchmen are good in this as well. But he does really do quite well in a film that really stands up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Trevelyan's I think Trevelyan is really unscrupulous because, yes, at first. What we're led to believe that he is motivated by the betrayal of his people, when in fact the reality is that he's a thief, and that's really all. He's abusing the suffering that he and his family and his people went through, really to just justify his thievery, and this so he's a traitor in that respect as well. He's not only is he a traitor to MI6. But he can't even justify his treachery by saying, "Actually, I'm sticking it to MI6 because, you know, I'm a Lienk's Cossack and I'm taking revenge." But he can't. So he's actually betraying that motive as well because all he actually wants to do is make a shit ton of cash, and so it works really well. And the way that he is a depraved character, and you know, it's just that perversion. He's a kind of mirror universe sort of like 00 really, and it works really well. But I mean, as a character in action, the way that he got introduced to us in that kind of double act, that tandem mission, was really, really good. I really enjoyed that the banter, the byplay, and the teamwork between Bond and Trevelyan in that pre-credit sequence, and it made his apparent demise in the pre-credit sequence and setup all the more powerful, because then when he returns later in the movie, we feel that sense of shock and betrayal as well.
Yeah.
And that's projected onto us and to on our emotions, and works extremely well from an audience point of view. This is the difference between having a well-written movie and a badly written movie.
And it
plays in really, really well, and he makes a very satisfying demise as well, of course.
Yes.
Graham, how much of Trevelyan being such a kind of effective villain and a villain who I think we've all got a lot of admiration for in terms of, you know, putting in the bottom villainry category, how much of it do you think is down to Sean Bean and picking that actor for the role?
I think it's very interesting because Sean Bean he was at the time on a lot of lists for being a potential Bond, wasn't he?
Easily, yeah. I mean, the moment that guy emerged, Sean Bean, you would have thought he is definitely one of these guys who's going to be thought about as the next James Bond.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that he's called Sean, so it gets him off to a good start.
Helpful, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, here you got a more rugged working class style one, like in the mould of Sean Connery. And then I thought, like, you're right, he was blonde, but.
You would have had no complaints if Sean Bean had been given that gig as James Bond.
No.
They were always going to go for Pierce Brosnan because they've been pursuing him for years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if there had been a problem and they'd gone, say, with Sean Bean, and he must have been in the top six. I would be astonished if they
were. Well, he even ditched his northern accent, which is what he's had in every role he's
ever
played.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
that's
a criticism of Sean Bean sometimes, is he's a bit one-dimensional and he's a bit of a professional northern. But that's largely because he kept being cast in those kind of roles.
Yeah.
But he showed his versatility there, and that he's a fine actor. He would have made an outstanding James Bond. And this again adds to the intrigue of this movie.
Yeah.
Is that Bond truly has met his match. He's up against another 00 agent.
It's pretty much the same as, you know, you've got Red Grant and Scaramanga. This is what you've got here again. This is another one of those interplays, which is good, which is sometimes what you want to see. In fact, if anything, you think if those two have a fight, I'm putting my money on Sean Bean.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, maybe in those action sequences, actually, it was, you know, Pierce is wonderful, but perhaps is not the
Most
best. In terms of the violence, in the actual visceral, the fighting and the fist fights and whatnot, maybe not as convincing as other James Bonds, and maybe not as convincing as Sean Bean. That's, if somebody was to say that, express it as an opinion, I'd have difficulty.
Yeah.
You know,
I would have been very interested to see Sean Bean being playing the same role up against Daniel Craig. And
yes.
You sort of think about those two beings. Imagine that first scene between the two of them in the dam, and imagine that there.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps in that respect,
in that modern, more visceral Craig era type,
you can imagine other James Bonds coming in and playing it and actually doing a better job, can't you, than Pierce Brosnan? Which is not what we're here for. We're not here to condemn Pierce because he was brilliant. But
taken a creative turn from them. I think after License to Kill, there was actually we're just aping modern action films here. Let's try to create a bit more of a Bond film. But
still informed by contemporary consensus.
Sure.
And that's the one of the reasons why, I mean, GoldenEye is a much loved and regarded as a classic, but I think there are also people who do see it as being a little bit at odds with itself at times. A lot of people point to the music soundtrack, for example, and think that that's sort of like, you know, with Eric Serra, very contemporary but sort of like out of step, while at the same time they're also making a very traditional James Bond movie, and it doesn't quite gel. And people say the same thing, I think, about License to Kill as well.
And also, I mean, one of the things that I think is when you have, we've talked about this in the past, probably most notable when you have an actor who's up against another actor as the villain, who perhaps has a slightly better range and depth. And yeah, again, this is no criticism of Pierce Brosnan per se, because I think he did a very good role as Bond. He played it in a way that was very distinctly his, and he really made the role his own. But I always can't help but feel that when James Bond is up against Alec Trevelyan and Pierce Brosnan is up against Sean Bean, Sean Bean can really act him off the stage. And those scenes with them in, there's a great kind of frisson in there, but you always are looking forward to the Sean Bean bits rather than the Pierce Brosnan bits in there.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, I can pretty much see that.
Hmm. if we're talking about, if we, obviously the wrestler villains are in the Brosnan era, and you talk about Pierce Brosnan being up against an actors who are you know, very good and can command the screen as well. A more interesting one is probably Electra King, played by Sophie Marceau. Long-term listeners will have obviously joined in on our DVD commentary of The World Is Not Enough. And as we sat down and watched it, I think all of us suddenly went, this is not as good a film as I remember it being. Oh dear, it's a little bit problematic. But one of the elements that does shine through is Sophie Marceau's performance in The World Is Not Enough, potentially aided a little bit by a henchman who probably in another film could have easily been a villain, which was Robert Carlyle in there. So, I mean, Sophie Marceau's Electra King is a really, really fascinating villain, and one that I actually, whilst I can't profess to say that I particularly think the film's good, Terry, you've got a really good actor here in a very interesting, meaty role that actually gives a bit of a twist that you don't necessarily see coming.
Yeah, I wasn't present, shall we say, for a lot of the build-up to The World Is Not Enough. But I can kind of imagine that if I were, then when they announced that Sophie Marceau was coming in as a Bond girl, because I assume that that's how they did it. It was a misdirect. It's like Sophie Marceau is coming in as a Bond girl, and a lot of people would have thought, "Wow, that's quite an impressive hire." Because obviously an achingly beautiful woman, but also an actress of substance, and not necessarily someone that you would associate with playing a Bond girl role. But obviously, it turns out that she wasn't playing the Bond girl; she was playing the Bond villain. And then it also cleverly recruited, bringing in Robert Carlyle and saying, "Look, we've got Robert Carlyle as a villain," and he was bang on at that time. I mean, still, you know, very much basking in the glory of Trainspotting and you know the roles that he was playing off the back of that. So there was that nice misdirect going on there. And I mean, I thought it's one of the elements of the movies, one of the few elements of the movies that worked was this sort of, you know, casting Elektra as the victim, as the helpless, semi-helpless victim. And foil, love foil, if you like, for Bond, and then actually then transitioning into a full-blown villain, and that again, working from Goldeneye to an extent, that kind of betrayal, you know, that sort of like misdirect, I thought worked really, really well. And I mean, I place Electra King very, very highly in the pantheons of villain. I mean, and it's more than just the novelty of the fact that she's a female lead villain, of which there are no others. Mm. Which I thought is quite a big deal, but I also think just on her own, I mean, she's just such an actress of great substance that, you know, again, in many ways, perhaps, you know, Pierce had to work pretty hard to live with her, if you take my meaning.
Oh, certainly, yeah. That's very, very much the issue, I think, with the two of them are on screen together.
Yeah.
She's the one carrying a lot of weight in those scenes.
Mm.
But that really helps. That really, because it really means that when her betrayal is exposed, or when her true plan is exposed, it makes the film have a bit more sense.
But she plays
only a bit.
She plays the audience, because James Bond audiences are a certain type. Let's not beat about the bush. Certainly, regular James Bond fans are. You know, I mean, we're used to our Bond women behaving in a certain way, and Elektra delivers that for us really, really well. And then she kind of slapped us around the face and says, actually, I'm not like that at all. I'm the one pulling all the strings here, and you've just been played. And so have you out there, you know, beyond the screen.
Suckers.
Suckers, yeah. Yeah. And in a better movie, it would have been awesome, but sadly, it's just such a bad film that it really gets lost in all the general rubbishness of the movie.
It is such a bad film. And of course, as we've discussed before, Robert Carlyle is shamefully underused in this film, especially with this one comes, you know, all right, it's his two films after Goldeneye, but you know, Robert Carlyle was deserving of a role as equal as Sean Bean. I mean, if anything, Robert Carlyle was probably at a higher position in his career than Sean Bean was back then.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I couldn't disagree with that. I mean, yeah. Sean Bean's still very much a TV actor.
Yeah.
And very much in, you know, never really had a massive cinema. I mean, you'd never, always played kind of supporting roles.
Yeah.
Whereas you felt that Robert Carlyle was heading in a different place and that this was a great time to get him. It's not quite worked out like that, in fairness, for Robert Carlyle. But I mean, he is an actor I would happily see return as another villain, you know, in another Bond movie,
certainly,
without any qualms whatsoever about the fact that he'd been in one beforehand. You have to take into account your disappointment that Robert Carlyle didn't feature more, while at the same time celebrating the fact that in Electric King we actually do have a really uncommon adversary and a very effective one as well.
Certainly. Uncommon, but there is a theme with all of these within this group, isn't there? Of the fact that the villains to begin with are part of the establishment, or they are seen to be on a certain side.
Yes.
And it goes on with our last villain as well, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yes.
And Gustav Graves. One couple of quick things that I'll mention before we move on to him. Part of me has always wondered with the character of Renard and Robert Carlyle in The World Is Not Enough, if the writers made a very, very deliberate attempt to get him as far away from the character of Begbie in Trainspotting, who is just a complete psychopath. And so they almost sort of took out a lot of the emotion from him, which maybe kind of stunted him a little bit. And also, the scenes between Sophie Marceau and Pierce Brosnan, obviously Pierce has to work very hard. The best scenes in it are the ones between Sophie Marceau and Judi Dench in that movie. They are fantastic, and there's a real crackle between those two whenever they go on screen.
Yes,
that is very, very true.
And
well worth raising.
It's almost Electric in a weird kind of way. You've got Renard, who is meant to be the equal of Bond, but actually Electric King is the equal of M, which is a really fascinating way of putting that movie together. And I think it's probably fair to say that we're all, whilst we none of us would have The World Is Not Enough, Not Enough particularly high in our best Bond films, I think we've got a lot of love for the character of Electra King.
Yeah,
I think so. She's gonna do well in the final tournament. She's definitely going to the finals,
yeah.
I think.
And those scenes with her and M do foreshadow what comes up in Skyfall as well.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you've got Judi Dench and you've got the opportunity to have Judi Dench in your film, then you're going to take advantage of it and you're gonna play up the role of M in that. And so there's definitely that kind of sins of the past thing, which is visited on M. In The World Is Not Enough, is revisited again in Skyfall, isn't it?
Yeah.
And with a very different outcome, however. Yeah, no, absolutely. Good shout, Gary. It's well worth remembering again. Sophie Marceau and Judi Dench. I mean, that's this is why when we did the DVD commentary,
we thought this is
a hidden gem. We're reassessing this movie's going to actually be an actual hidden classic. It's a forgotten Bond film, and we were wrong. It's a forgettable Bond film.
Well, as forgettable as the next one, though.
No, it's true.
And sometimes I do wish I could. If we have a lot of love for Electra King, Graham, how much love do you have for Gustav Graves?
Absolutely none. Really, this is
just terrible.
Toby
Stevens is a fine actor.
He's
and deserved a much better character.
Yeah, but no, he got Gustav Graves in an absolute horror show of a film. We've explained on previous podcasts how terrible Die Another Day is.
Yeah.
We don't need to explain how terrible Die Another Day is.
Yeah, I mean, I think they dressed him up in an Iron Man suit in the climax. I think that just tells you everything you need to know about just how much this whole movie lost its way and just how much they lost their way with the character.
Yeah.
Highlights for me, Gustav Graves, is the sword fight in London for me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an enjoyable fight.
It was an enjoyable fight, yeah.
Yeah. But it was a well choreographed fight.
Yeah. It was well choreographed.
That's the best I can do. The action scenes with which he's in are well choreographed mostly. And that's as best as I can. That's all I've got.
And the worst thing is that from the time when he turns up, the film is garbage.
Yeah. Yeah, because the film, it is, we've said this before, the movie turns, it's London Calling, isn't it? It's when he parachutes into Buckingham Palace like a complete knob. And you know, I mean, like, Bond villains can't be knobs, right? They just can't be knobs. There has to be something, you know, about
they can be knobbish.
Yeah, not yeah, yeah, and they could do yeah awful things, but you know, anyway. I mean, he's just, and then after that, the movie just goes head south, just like completely. I mean, it's almost like symbolic of the movie's downfall.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, because at that point, it's actually quite an engaging film, and we're thinking, ha, here we go. But yeah, yeah. I mean, he just completely ruins it. It's a completely stupid premise. This creation, this conversion into from Colonel Mooney, the DNA resequencing is just bad science fiction. It's rubbish science fiction.
Yeah,
and you know,
it's like Face Off, isn't it?
I mean, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, but that movie has charm and some really, really, really tour de force performances by Cage.
Yeah.
And by John Travolta, and it's a movie that that realises its own absurdity and goes for it.
Yeah.
It's a very sincere film.
But let's face it,
Diana of the Day, no one believes any word they're saying in that movie.
Yeah, and if you're going to choose an action film to be your reference point for your own film, you could find better ones than Face Off, can't you?
You could indeed, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're going to pick a John Woo film, then there are other John Woo films to knock off. I think it's a real... All bad James Bond films are such a missed opportunity because they cost such a lot of money to put on,
yeah.
And they take up so much of people's time. And it's really sad when they come out just like that. And I'm afraid Gustav Graves sums that up.
There is nothing to redeem that film, especially the parts with Gustav Graves in.
Yeah.
He's an awful villain in an awful half of an awful film.
Yeah.
It's,
he feels like to me that he belongs, and again, when he parachutes in, and no matter how many times I've watched that, and unfortunately I watched it quite a bit, it feels as if he's actually come from a parody of a Bond film, which is never a good thing, because even in some of the bad Bond films, or the ones that are perhaps much less loved. I mean, obviously, we've just talked about The World Is Not Enough. Neither Robert Carlyle, neither Renard nor Electra King would be seen as a parody. If you take For Your Eyes Only, Julian Glover's character would not be seen as a parody. You know, they give it the rule, whereas there's just something so off tonally in that, and I don't know whether it was the direction as well that was given to him to ham it up in a certain way. It's just, there's just something about him that you just feel that he's stepped into the wrong movie from a wrong set, and you've just gone, what on earth's gone on here? And then you talk about the movie being an utter waste. The idea of building an ice palace, that's quite cool, and yet they still managed to make that really boring. And it was kind of, when I remember watching it, the first time, and then latterly after the Watchmen movie came out, and obviously I've read the comics, because the climax of that also takes place in a bit of a kind of ice palace cold era in there. And you know, if the minute you think of that, you just go, well, it's going nowhere near this at all. It's already been outdone by Alan Moore in a comic strip, which, to be fair, a lot of things are. And you've got a villain there who just, you've no idea where to put him at all, or why he's there. He has very little point. I sound a bit like Chris Sutton at that point, don't I?
Yeah, no, but I mean, your Sutton-esque criticism is absolutely bang on point there. I mean, we've said this before in previous podcasts, and this is always a thing with that it's worth hammering home. These Bond movies are difficult enough to get away with because their principles are so outlandish. But what you have to do is you have to be sincere. The director of On Her Majesty's Secret Service said, in a commentary during On Her Majesty's Secret Service, he said, look, you know, he was talking about the bit where Bond is opening the door with the rubber, and he said, it's ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't work like that. He said, but you have to play it sincerely. You have to be absolutely 100%. You have to believe that what you're doing can be done. Otherwise, audiences just don't respond to it. Mm. And he's absolutely right. I mean, the sincerity in James Bond films is absolutely key. And you can get away with almost anything in a James Bond movie. But the moment you take that out of it, all is lost. And I'm afraid this is what happens with Die Another Day, which famously, of course, had multiple rewrites during production and was a troubled production.
Well,
they lost faith in the movie, I think.
What has also got to be remembered is that the period of Brosnan's films were in that period, after the Berlin Wall comes down, and you've got 9/11.
Yeah.
So they're bookended by that. And actually, this film comes out after 9/11,
yeah.
And the world has changed from when this this film was written. The world has changed in one day, and the film doesn't reflect that change.
It was all set up to.
Yeah.
Because I mean, M, there's a confrontation with M, you know, behind the glass with Bond, in which she says precisely that: while you were gone, the world changed.
Yeah.
And she's referring to 9/11.
Yeah.
And he said, not for me. And we were set up for, you know, what we hope would be some kind of movie based upon this kind of inner conflict that was going to go along there. This was all set up to be a cracking movie. I mean, that's another reason why, again, the common theme, betrayal. Only this time, it's the producers who betray the audience, you know, in the nicest possible way. You know, I mean, set up this great movie and deliver just a shit show.
In fact, what you could have is you could have the last three quarters of Skyfall just stuck on to the first half of Die Another Day, and you'd actually have a film.
Yeah. Yeah, it is so disappointing the way that movie just goes. It was so it started off so promisingly. I was really enjoying it. And then, oh well.
I think it's fair to say that we would not be clamouring for the return of Gustav Graves in any shape or form in any future Bond era. I think even taking out the fact that Die Another Day is a dreadful film, he's still a dreadful character, and he's been given so little to work with. Some villains you could say, oh, you know what, if a few tweaks here, a few tweaks there, and they would be fine. Or, you know, as you just said, you could sort of put them into another film. In this case, there's nothing there. He's got, I feel so sorry for Toby Stevens, because he's got so little to work with. I suspect the direction was telling him to just, you know, not enough ham, keep on adding more ham into your performance. More ham, more ham, more ham. And that's where you get to. So
if you were to have a monster rally, an old school, like those Universal monster rallies that they used to do, but you had a Bond villain rally movie, Gustav Gray would either be the first one to go in it, or he would just be completely forgotten about. And he'd have just turned up. He'd be the guy who turns up at the end of the end credits and say, oh, what about me? What about me? I'm still here. Nobody cares.
So shall we finish off this, as we are want to do, with how we are proposing to rank this? And I think this is going to be interesting, because it's not... I'm fascinated to see if there's a clear winner or not, and I think there's a clear loser. We know what that is in there. So Terry, I'll come to you first.
Well, I'll put Graves as bottom. I will work from the bottom up, I think, because I haven't actually made up my mind yet. So I'll just open my mouth and see what comes out.
I think we're all agreeing. Roger Moore eyebrow there. Yeah, working from the bottom up.
I'm going to go for Graves and bottom as well.
And then I'm going to have to put Dominic Green above him, because, you know, he's fairly lightweight for reasons that we've gone into, and there is, so really it's it's really between Trevelyan and Electric King, and I've got to be honest and say I'm really not certain who I would go with there. I will say Trevelyan, because he's in a better movie, but I mean I think if Sophie Marceau, if the World Is Not Enough had been a better movie, then I think that Electric King would be one of the great Bond villains of all time.
Yeah.
In all sincerity. So, Trevelyan, King, Green, and Graves. Have I missed someone else?
No. I think there's enough to Electric King to put her ahead of Trevelyan.
Good for you.
But I think she really has to work at that, and that's what she does in the film.
Yeah.
And I think, because Trevelyan's villainy is more of an ensemble, then I think that's what allows, for me anyway, Electric King to rise above, despite being in a very, very ordinary film, that she shines in it.
Yeah, for me, I would also put Electric Ink, and it's really tight. It's kind of like, you know, cigarette paper thin margins, because I think they're both very good characters. And I think the reason that a couple of reasons that I've put Electric Ink a little bit higher is really the fact that we have a lot of praise for her in what is not a very good film. And when you've got a villain who you can find a lot to like about in a film which you really would probably flick over onto the other side if it came on, or you'd just be a bit like, okay, I'll watch it, but reluctantly. Whereas GoldenEye, we can all watch through. We know how good it is. And as you know, there's a lot of great supporting characters in there. Whereas as Electric Ink just has that, there's that surprise that comes from it as well. And there's the fact that she actually plays the audience exceptionally well. And I don't think it's necessarily a twist that when you watch it for the first time, you see coming. It's not signposted particularly obviously in there, which again, I think is a really, you know, it's unusual for a Bond film to have that villain twist revealed quite so far down the track in there. You know who you're fighting, or you think you know you're fighting. So, and you know, it's the fact that she is very clever in how she commands things. And you've obviously mentioned those great scenes between her and Judi Dench, and she doesn't even see herself as an equal of Bond. She sees herself as an equal of the head of MI6, which is fantastic. So, yeah, I'm putting her up there for those reasons. Like, you could very easily make a case for Trevelyan. As I say, it's very, very close, between them. So, yeah, that was a really interesting bunch, because I don't think they are necessarily, I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be first choice. I don't think any of those as a standout villain, but they've got a lot of depth to them, a lot to like about them. Although some in there probably fall, in James Bond's opinion, in the case of Christoph Gross, probably lower than a C in there. But yes, we've now gone through the set of villains. So what comes next, chaps, is now that we've discussed them all in depth, I think we need to have a proper World Cup to settle this all.
It's the only thing that we can do.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what this whole business over the last year that we've been doing this has all been about.
We'll get all the names together.
Yep.
We'll get the ones, the best out of this lot together. Yep. And we won't need to explain too much in depth when we go through those groups. And people will know why we're putting people ahead of others. But then, even by the time we get round to discussing it, when push comes to shove, when we're pushing one against the other, if Trevelyan and King come together in the quarterfinals somehow, you know, we might change our minds.
We might well change our minds. Yeah, who knows?
It's all about on the day, isn't it? Really,
it is indeed. It's what happens on the day, Clive.
Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So you can expect that coming up. Well, I mean, relatively soon. I mean, probably sometime in the late winter, perhaps early spring. We'll be getting together to do that, and that's going to be an absolute mammoth. Who knows? Maybe we'll even have a wall chart.
Maybe we will.
But if you, I mean, maybe not. I don't know whether or not we've asked our wall chart guy whether or not he's prepared to do it. Gary, did you ask our wall chart guy?
I've not asked our wall chart guy. Okay, waiting for the opportune moment.
I might edit this out just in case wall chart guy's not forthcoming.
Do you think wall chart guy listens to this?
Oh, I know Wall Chart Guy listens to this. I mean, I know. I'm almost certain that Wall Chart Guy knows right now who he is, don't you, Chris? So, anyway, this is all going to get edited out, so it doesn't matter. What won't be edited out, however, is I will leave a note, a link in the show notes, listeners, for our World Cup of James Bond films. So, if you didn't listen to that, then do listen to that. You need to give yourself a couple of hours.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. a mammoth podcast, but and it's also very drunk as well. So, you might not. So anyway, so yeah, pour yourself a stiff whiskey and or a vodka martini and enjoy with us, because it was tremendous fun to do. And I'll also leave a link to the World Is Not Enough DVD commentary, because we mentioned that a couple of times, just in case you haven't got yourself around that. So if you are minded to watch that film again, think, these guys' opinions on The World Is Not Enough are wrong.
Yeah, I remember this is a brilliant much better
film. I remember this movie, and it's the perfect Bond film. And then you can sit down and listen along with us and just
realise why you haven't watched it in 15
years. How terribly
years.
Wrong your opinion is. Yeah.
If you have that opinion, you've probably had quite a few vests by that point, I would say. Yes, so we will be returning with the World Cup. I suspect somehow this one will be a little less drunken, given that we're not trying to get through every single bottle of alcohol in my house before I emigrate, unfortunately. So it will probably be have a little bit more thought and a little less spontaneity from, what, three bottles of port, was it?
I think so.
Yeah, so whether that's for the better or not, I'll let you to decide. But for that point, I think it's time that we wrap up, and we probably do. You know, it's probably a good time to pour ourselves a stiff one. It's always 5 o'clock somewhere in the world. And so with that, we'll be getting out the vodka martinis, shaken, not stirred, the Vespas are for later. And it just remains for me to thank Graham and Terry for their building it to the climax of villainy before we start getting into the nitty-gritty of the World Cup. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much indeed for your hospitality.
And we will be back. The Odd Job Pod will return soon. Until that time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.